Great Mass of Color, een nieuw nummer van Death Heaven. Hun nieuwe plaat is voor eind augustus en daarop drijven ze nog verder af van hun metalverleden en ze gaan meer richting shoegaze, postrock en zelfs pop. En van Death Heaven is de stap naar King Woman niet zo groot. Producer Jack Shirley zat achter de knoppen bij Sunbather, de doorbraak van Death Heaven. Hij deed dat nu ook bij Celestial Blues, de nieuwe plaat van King Woman. Dat is een van de donkere muzikale projecten van de Amerikaans-Iraanse Christina Esfardiani. Dit is Morningstar van King Woman. We'll be right back.
Paranoia Troef in deze Hounds in the Abyss van Alexis Marshall. Dat is de zanger van Daughters, die trakteerde ons in dit nummer op zijn soloplaat House of Lull, House of When, op een fikse portie industriële noise. De Hounds of the Abyss, of de helle honden, die kondigde in de Griekse mythologie de naderende dood aan van een naaste. Mag even uitblijven wat ons betreft, behalve dan die plaat van Alexis Marshall zelf, maar die komt er ook al binnen een maand. Codex Serafini, een Brits viertal, bracht vandaag een nieuw EP'tje uit. Op Invisible Landscape reist het viertal weer door hun eigen kosmos. Van daaruit straalt ze onder andere dit nummer door Time Change and Become van Codex Serafini.
Thank you.
Chimp is vooral een straffe liveband, maar op hun nieuwe vijfde plaat staan toch ook weer een paar ferme songs. Drool is net uit en daaruit draaiden we Wallow van PodChimp dus. Het Franse One Arm bestaat al sinds de jaren 90, maar pas dit jaar verscheen hun debuutplaat Missouri Pak. Dat is dan ook een verzameling nummers geschreven in de afgelopen decennia. Maar toch klinkt de plaat coherent. Ze is volledig ingespeeld met de huidige bezetting. Twee bassisten en twee drummers. Hier is Real van One Arm. It's real.
Uit het debuut van One Arm. En zo zit onze eerste live-uitzending, echte live-uitzending vanuit de beruchte Radio Scorpio Studio sinds 16 oktober vorig jaar er echt op. Dadelijk is er Sterrenplaten. Wij gaan eruit met een improfproject rond Kip Malone van TV on the Radio en John Dwyer van The OCs. Samen nodigden ze nog een boel muzikale vrienden uit naar de studio van Dwyer in LA. En daar speelden ze een vijftal dagen samen. Uit die sessies verscheen eerder al het band Arcana en nu is er Moon Drenched. Trippy improvisaties van een stel rasmuzikanten. Dit is eruit de War Clock. Tot volgende week.
We'll be right back. It's an unusually warm, quiet night in late September. It's been just a few weeks since 9/11, but it's not the 9/11 you're probably thinking of. The original 9/11. The day of Chile's brutal military coup. The coup that cost Salvador Allende his life. And Chile, its precious democracy. The coup of 1973. As with the other 9/11, our story starts in New York. And yes, a huge explosion looms large on the horizon. Someone has just phoned the New York Times about a bomb, and it's ticking in the very heart of Manhattan. The target is ITT, a mighty tech giant with links to the CIA and the military. A company almost universally disliked. A company whose Chilean holdings were nationalized by Allende. They hated him for it. And now that he's dead, someone must be taking revenge. But who? Minutes go by, then hours. Perhaps it was just a prank call. Perhaps ITT would not have to pay for its sins in Chile after all. Perhaps they'll get away with it. But then, at 5:40 in the morning, things do take a turn for the worse. Boom. The explosion that shakes Madison Avenue marks a tragic end to Allende's ambitious agenda. His bold efforts to reclaim technology have failed. And Chile paid dearly for his democratic vision. A vision that we're still missing today. And badly so. Welcome to the Santiago Boys, a podcast where technology is politics and politics is technology. I'm Evgeny Morozov, and for the past 2 years, I've been chasing a wild Latin American dream. A tech utopia that helps us deal with our own dystopian present. This is not your typical technology podcast. Rather, it's a tribute to Allende's utopian engineers, I call them the Santiago Boys, who dared to imagine a very different digital future. A future where technology helps democracy, not ruins it. Where big data means solidarity, not surveillance. Forget instruments of repression. The Santiago Boys saw computers as liberty machines. They saw that engineers should transform the world instead of merely trying to control it. And remarkably, they almost did. Until, of course, Allende's enemies put a bloody end to the tech utopia. It's a wild story from more than 50 years ago, and I do know it might get dizzy at times. But I promise you, in the end, it will all make sense. I do know that 9 episodes is a long ride, so let me give you a quick taste of Allende's enemies, but also some of his secret tech weapons. And as far as his enemies are concerned, we don't even have to leave New York. But before we resume our story, you might enjoy knowing that I produced most of this podcast in a very different setting. I've been working like mad in a small town in the south of Italy, in Calabria to be exact, but was surrounded by mountains and forests and some animals. Initially thought it would be a quick job, I'd be here for a few months at most. But it actually turned into a truly quixotic mission. A mission that took me 2 years. And it involved more than 200 interviews and quite a few archival visits. And definitely a lot of false starts and leads. Just to give you an idea, I've written at least 11 different versions of the script for this podcast. And what started as popular history of a mysterious cybernetic room in Santiago soon morphed into something so much larger. A tale involving geopolitics, spies, big tech, and of course Salvador Allende. At the beginning, I thought that Allende would be just a minor historical character in this tale. But as I dug deeper, I've understood that the Chilean president is absolutely crucial to understanding everything that you're about to hear. So we jump straight to an important point in Allende's presidency. He realizes he's running out of time. His revolution has stalled. His enemies are plotting against him. What is he supposed to do? It's late 1972, almost 11 months before that explosion. We are at the luxurious Waldorf Astoria Hotel, just blocks from the ITT building. Normally, this place is the playground of the rich and the powerful. But tonight, it's a no man's land between socialism and capitalism. A place where Allende gets his last chance to mend fences with America. Had this meeting gone differently, The ITT explosion may have never happened.
The meeting took place in a small sitting room on the 26th floor of the hotel at 10:30 p.m. President Allende, speaking through an interpreter, appeared relaxed.
These are the words of George H.W. Bush, and are spoken by an actor. At the time, Bush is the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. In front of him is an avuncular man in his mid-60s. He's wearing horn-rimmed glasses that make him look like a college professor.
The president wore a quasi-Mao jacket. As soon as we sat down, somebody passed out scotch. The president took a scotch on the rocks with a little bit of water.
The Maoist jacket, the scotch, the luxurious hotel. Allende is like this. He's a walking paradox, a bundle of contradictions. Contradictions that could never be reconciled. Sure, he loves the contrast, the evil capitalist and the poor workers, but let's face it, he also loves his oysters and his whiskey and his fancy shirts. And don't forget those famous Chilean delicacies, red wine and empanadas. Both have in fact become the very symbols of his revolution. A revolution that has captivated the world, but has also earned Allende many enemies. And not just in Chile. Allende is in New York to address the United Nations, but trust me, it won't be one of those boring speeches. No, he wants to attack big American companies. He thinks they're bad for Chile. And Washington, as you probably guessed, is not at all thrilled about this speech. So Ambassador Bush is here to talk some good sense into Allende. He must still convince him to change something in tomorrow's speech. There is no need for attacks. America means well.
I said there may have been excesses from time to time, but basically the American people believe deeply in free enterprise and in capitalism and in investment. Not in a selfish sense, but because we felt that it was the best way to provide a better standard of living for all.
This encounter is not a mere shouting match. Driving it is a geopolitical battle for the very meaning of technological autonomy. Should countries like Chile get their technologies from the US? Or should they avoid any such dependencies and build their own? This, at any rate, is what Allende wants. And his utopian engineers can't wait to do this. And when we look at the bills that Chile has to pay, they might have a point. All those fees for copyright, licenses, trademarks cost a fortune. So while Bush is here to impede Chile's past technological autonomy, Allende is doing his best to advance it. Now, according to Bush, the meeting ends on a high note.
Allende gave me several very firm handshakes, looked me directly in the eye, seemed to go out of his way to be warm and friendly.
Allende's colleagues remember it differently. When Allende mentions that the CIA may have been trying to topple him, Bush defends the agency. Deeply offended, Allende stands up, thanks Bush for his time, and points to the door. The meeting is over. He won't be changing a single comma in tomorrow's speech. Has he just signed his own death warrant? The following morning, Allende ascends the stage at the United Nations.
Agradezco el alto honor que se me hace al invitarme a ocupar esta tribuna.
He's feeling the pain of his new shoes, but this is vintage Allende, a provincial man trying to make an impression on the sophisticated crowd in Manhattan. There's been a bit of a change in appearance for our Marxist friend here. He's ditched the Maoist jacket for a banker-like outfit, but when he starts talking, you know that this guy is anything but a banker.
Estamos frente a un verdadero conflicto frontal sobre las grandes corporaciones transnacionales y los estados.
Allende argues that corporations should not interfere with sovereign nations, and that the smaller countries need to come together and make a whole new global economy, an economy to defend against the big tech of the day, the likes of ITT.
La ITT, gigantesca corporación, cuyo capital es superior al presupuesto nacional de varios países latinoamericanos juntos.
Yes, that's ITT that Allende is attacking here. He's accusing it of nothing less than trying to foment a civil war in Chile. These are not light charges. As he finishes his speech, the room erupts in thunderous applause. Cautiously, Allende heads towards the throne-like chair near where he just spoke. He acknowledges his admirers with a salute, taking in the moment. However, as he settles into the seat, his expression changes dramatically from confidence to gloom and yet tragedy. He must know that Chile's peaceful road to socialism has been anything but, and the path ahead will be filled with explosives, nails, mines, and missiles. A tragic end looms on the horizon. I do know that I also promised to show you some of Allende's secret tech weapons. So, here we are. A few weeks go by, and Allende is back in Santiago. Only this time, he's sitting in a room that looks like something straight out of a sci-fi movie. It's a futuristic space, complete with sleek data screens and mysterious interfaces. This place is the beating heart and brain of Project Cybersyn, Allende's groundbreaking attempt at managing the Chilean economy. It's like a shrine to the gods of big data.
I remember being there once, and it looked like what you see in the films. It was attractive.
It was something that gave you an impression that you're living in a different world.
Certainly, it was an unusual setting. You would not expect it in a normal office. The white chairs, these different screens.
In the middle of the room, there are seven white chairs that form a circle. Allende sits in one of them, and as he spins around, he takes in all the unique decor. There are these cool orange cushions on the chairs. They might seem like a subtle detail, but they add so much personality to the space. And then, with a mere push of a button on the chair's armrest, Allende opens up a portal to a vast world of data that is both enigmatic and exciting. This data can help him build a new kind of socialism in Chile, the cybernetic one.
So we had this room, no paper, all automatic, all screens, all under the control of the people sitting in the chairs, capable of doing national simulations.
And that voice you are hearing now is none other than Stafford Beer, the man behind the whole operation, the cyber scenery in chief. He's quite the character, to say the least. And as we dig deeper into his story, we'll get a glimpse into the mind of this complex and fascinating man. Before we do that, though, we must get to know the Santiago boys, the utopian engineers that brought him to Chile. Without them, the worlds of Beer and Allende would have never collided. But how did these middle-class engineers even end up in politics? And not just any politics, but Allende's leftist politics. And how did they come to worship an upper-class British management consultant? That doesn't make much sense, does it? Yes, we do have quite a few riddles here. And to solve them, we do need to tell this story chronologically, from the mid-1960s onwards. Yes, I know, it might occasionally seem over the top and confusing, but let's face it, real history is like this. And as they say, those who don't learn from it are doomed to repeat it. And given how tragic all of this is, that's not at all what we want to do. It all begins in Santiago, on an otherwise ordinary August day in 1967. This is when progressive students take over the Catholic University, the bastion of the country's elite. Our own Santiago boys, most of them studying engineering, are among them. Little do they know, this is so much more than a mere student gathering. It will transform Chile for good.
The Toma, the occupation of the Catholic University, was the starting point of our entering politics at the national level.
This is Gabriel Rodriguez. Back then, just a student of engineering, active in university politics. He'll be our guide through the Santiago Boys universe.
When we started the student movement, we were quite dissatisfied with what was happening in the country in terms of the social situation, the economic situation, injustice.
The occupation shakes the conservative university to its core, opening up a much-needed conversation.
We called the university was a kind of closed tower, and we would like to open it to the country, to incorporate the contradictions of the country.
It's a debate for the ages. What is the purpose of a university? Is it simply to produce graduates who are experts in their fields? Or is it also meant to spark societal change? And once they're out there in the world, should these graduates be prioritizing their careers or their ethics. With role models like Salvador Allende, Fidel Castro, and Che Guevara, the Santiago boys know where they stand on this one.
En mi país, los médicos saben que la salud se compra y que hay mucha gente que no puede comprar la salud.
Allende himself starts as a doctor, but soon he understands that health problems have social and political origins. So he abandons medicine and becomes a politician. Some, however, go even farther. They want the revolution now.
Nosotros queremos construir el socialismo. Nos hemos declarado partidarios de los que luchan por la paz.
This is the voice of Che Guevara, another popular student idol at the time. He too starts as a doctor, but when he goes to Guatemala in the early 1950s, he sees its government overthrown. The CIA and the United Fruit Company are partly to blame. This is what turns one humble doctor into the world's most famous guerrilla fighter. And then, of course, there is Fidel Castro. As a young lawyer, yeah, that's how he starts out, Castro fights an American corporation that is pillaging his native Cuba. He wins the case, but the country's then dictator reverses the decision. The courtroom is no longer the right stage for Fidel Castro's battles. But what about the engineers? Will they follow the example of radical doctors and lawyers? Of Allende, Che Guevara, and Fidel Castro? The Santiago boys very much hope so, and they will do their bit. Here's Gabriel Rodriguez again.
We knew about technology. We knew what was possible to be done in Chile and what not.
Rejecting the militant path of Castro and Che Guevara, they endorse Allende's peaceful and democratic vision,